Welcome to Scientifica, the premier podcast where the latest scientific discoveries are discussed in the context of their apologetic significance to the Christian faith.
This is Average Joe Aguirre, joined today by members of our scholar team, astronomer Hugh Ross, biochemist Fuzz Rana, astrophysicist Jeff Zwerink, and molecular biologist A.J. Roberts. They will be sharing exciting research from the front lines of the scientific journals and discussing the apologetic implications. You will hear from each in roundtable fashion today, and we have done the obligatory toss of the dice. These are foam dice, and Hugh, you have turned up first, and the score was 5.
Right. I beat everybody with a score of 5.
You beat 5, so you're feeling rather fortunate and have promised to go to Las Vegas to try your good fortune there as well, right?
No.
All right. Well, we've been arguing about...
It's not Las Vegas. It's Las Wages.
Las Wages. There you go. We've been arguing about sports and curling and softball and everything else, so hopefully we can discuss some of the apologetic implications of the various discoveries on the table today, including this one, Hugh, which... has to do with a supernova in the past and the cosmic rays that may help explain Earth's fossil record history. From what I gather, it's about 2.6 million years ago. Is that correct?
They're looking at two supernova events.
Oh, two. Okay.
Yeah. One about between 1.7 and 2.7 million years ago. Another one between 6.5 and 8.7 million years ago.
All right, I was off on that.
Well, I mean, it's not a very accurate date, and there's a reason why. This was discovered through looking at iron 60 isotopes in various Earth rocks. And we know iron 60 is an isotope that's given off by supernova eruptions. It's really the only place you get iron 60. But it has a fairly short half-life. And that explains why we couldn't get a really accurate date. But what's exciting about the paper is that they got an accurate enough measure of these iron 60 isotopes to determine how far away the supernova were. And this is basically a follow-up of a previous paper. By the way, it does involve one of the astronomers who's a Christian and has partnered with us in the past, Brian Thomas. He's one of the authors on the paper.
All right.
And, he and his thesis supervisor, Andrew Malott, have been publishing a number of these papers looking at the effects of supernova and gamma ray bursts on the history of life on planet Earth.
Okay.
So this is the latest update. And basically they're reporting that we need to move our supernova estimates a lot closer to the Earth.
Okay. Where are you going with this as a teaser? What does this help explain?
Well, it helps explain certain anomalies we see in the fossil record, and what it actually shows is just what a remarkable time in which we human beings live. That relatively nearby supernova eruptions are the norm for the history of life on planet Earth, but during the era in which we humans live, there haven't been any nearby supernova eruptions, and therefore our lifespans haven't been impacted, or our health, or the productivity of the crops on which we depend. Hmm. So there's more evidence that we really do live in a truly exceptional time, which would be evidence that God timed the creation of Adam and Eve with everything he knew about our galaxy, making sure that we had all the conditions and resources we need to develop a very large population of humans. As I mentioned in Improbable Planet, what we see in the book of Revelation is a statement indicating that God intends to redeem billions of human beings, not just millions, but billions. And this requires extraordinary conditions in our Milky Way galaxy and here on planet Earth. And this is more evidence in support of just what a remarkably fine-tuned era in which we human beings live, but also reflects on various controversies in the evolution of biology. The paper actually ends with the statement that we think we've got a good explanation for why molecular clocks and the fossil record are so discordant. The reason being that we haven't taken into account the impact of cosmic rays and muons being given off by relatively nearby supernova eruptions. And we take that into consideration. Now we've got a good understanding for why molecular clocks are such a poor way of trying to determine, when things happen in the history of life on planet Earth.
Mm. All right. So what in particular did they find that was different from what they knew before? They're checking these iron 60 isotopes, as you mentioned. Where did they find these?
Well, they find them in different rock deposits of the Earth. I mean, if you got a supernova erupting, you're going to get iron 60 isotopes impacting the Earth. And so that they basically are measuring the abundance of iron 60. That abundance tells them how nearby the supernova eruption was. And so they're reporting on the fact that based on the more comprehensive measurements, that what they mentioned in their previous papers needs to be altered. And basically what they were suggesting is in the past 10 million years, there haven't been any supernova closer than about 100 parsecs, which is 325 light years. But they're now saying that, based on the new data, we need to move these supernova a lot closer to the Earth. And so they're now saying 50 rather than 100.
All right.
Or to put that in light years, that's now 163 light years away rather than 325. And so they said that's close enough that it would have significant impact on life here on planet Earth. And the rest of the paper is basically devoted as to what that impact would be. And there's three things that they point out would be significant. One would be the cosmic rays, the other would be the muons, and the third thing would be the brightness of the supernova in the nighttime sky and the impact that would have on life. They do point out that the previous conclusions by astronomers that the big impact would be ultraviolet radiation and X-ray radiation from the supernova. They said, yes, that would be serious if we're talking like 10 to 15 parsecs or 5 parsecs, but if we're talking 50, it doesn't have a significant impact of life here on planet Earth. But they said the cosmic rays definitely do, and the muons even more so. And the thing about muons, they penetrate water. And so, I mean, with cosmic rays, you can say, well, that's going to impact land life. The muons actually impact sea life. And we're talking down to over 1,000 meters depth. So it's not just the surface sea life, but the life at great depth would be impacted by muons.
So what was the timing again for this event?
Well, they say the iron 60 isotopes that they've measured indicate that there is a supernova 50 parsecs away, 163 light years away, somewhere around 7 million years ago, 6 to 7 million years ago, and then a second event in the neighborhood of 2 million years ago.
And what kind of life would we have had on Earth at that time?
Well, if we're talking 2 million years ago, you've got bipedal primates running around.
Okay, so they would have been affected in what
They would
way?
Have been affected. All mammals would have been affected.
Wiped out or significantly affected?
Well, they say that early in the paper that this would not lead to a mass extinction event.
All right.
Where you got like half of all life wiped out or more. They said that would happen if we're talking just 5 parsecs away. They also calculate how frequently we're going to get a 5 parsec supernova event. And they said roughly once every billion years, maybe a little more rapidly than that, but on the order of, say, half a billion to a billion light years, you'll get an event like that, which means that maybe 2 or 3 mass extinction events could be attributed to a nearby supernova eruption. But, the big 5 that we see in the fossil record, they would conclude that none of them would be connected with a supernova eruption. On the other hand, they did say, we're talking 50 parsecs away, that would give you an elevated extinction rate, not a mass extinction event, but definitely an elevated extinction rate in the fossil record.
All right. So how do you connect that then with your statement at the beginning that this is all in preparation for God preparing the planet for our ultimate
purpose? Having
read
the paper, it's like, given how frequently supernova erupt in our Milky Way galaxy, and given that the eruptions tend to be in the spiral arms, in the disk of the galaxy, and that's, kind of where our sun orbits, we're going to get supernova eruption events 50 parsecs away on a fairly frequent basis. Fairly frequent, similar to what we see here in this paper. Every few million years, something like that will happen.
So 50 is better than whatever it was before, 100?
Well, 100 parsecs away means that the impact on the Earth would be only one quarter of what it would be if we're talking 50 parsecs.
So not wiped out frequently enough then to
Well, if
to
it's 100 parsecs away, I mean, that's not going to have a big impact. I mean, for example, we do know that there were 23 supernova erupting during the last ice age. That were less than 1,000 light years away from the Earth, so that'd be like 1 to 300 parsecs. And again, that's kind of normative, and that's over a period of about 100,000 years.
Well, and you do also have to answer that question. It depends on what actually causes the damage, because if the X-rays and ultraviolet light is what does it, that's a more immediate effect because that propagates through the galaxy, whereas the cosmic rays... That enriches the galactic cosmic ray flux, but those cosmic rays actually don't make it directly to the Earth because the magnetic field bends them around, and so they have a much longer residence time in the galaxy.
Well, they actually calculated that, you know, how long would the damaging effects on life on planet Earth be, and they say roughly in the order of 10,000 years. So you're going to get a window about 10,000 years wide where you're going to have this elevated mutation rate and extinction rate, and damage to, especially the vascular plants are going to be impacted significantly. And we're talking muons. That's going to affect sea life to the same degree that the land life is impacted. But what's interesting is they calculated the impact of what would happen if you get a supernova erupting 50 light year, 50 parsecs away. It's 163 light years away. What if that were to, what impact that would have? Well, it basically means that the nighttime illumination is going to be very high. And so they actually calculated what that impact has, particularly on more advanced animals. Totally disrupts their circadian rhythms, because now you've got bright light at night and not just in the daytime. And how this could have an impact on extinction rates, because you're going to have these animals reproducing at the wrong time, feeding at the wrong time. So that's something that's new. I haven't seen in an astrophysical journal article before, is actually calculating the impact and what would happen. For example, even the supernova that exploded in 1054 AD, that was 5,000 light years away. So very far away compared to the ones they're looking at. Nevertheless, that supernova was visible in the daytime. That's how bright it was. So they're basically saying, hey, with something 50 parsecs away, you're going to have a really bright nighttime sky, assuming that the supernova erupts in a part of the sky that would be distant from where the sun would be. So,
all right, so you're seeing this as orchestrated by God as the creator then to bring about the extinction of...
Well, orchestrated
animals.
In this way, I think what they're documenting is that this is normative. You know, given that our Milky Way galaxy has about 3 supernova eruptions per century over the history of life on planet Earth.
Per century, wow.
What we're seeing here in this paper is normative, and so what we're seeing now is really the exceptional period. It's something I wrote about an improbable planet, how during the last ice age, you had 23 supernova erupting less than 1,000 light years away from the Earth. But in the last 9,000 years, there hasn't been a supernova closer than 5,000 light years. And with supernova that distance, it has no impact on human health, human lifespans, or food productivity from the plants on which we depend. But if you're talking supernova eruptions that are, say, 800 light years away or 500 light years away, that's going to impact human health, and it's definitely going to impact food productivity. And so it's one explanation for why humans during the last ice age did not develop a large population or high technology. And so it's like God, I think, was actually saying, hey, this is the window of time for humans. It's the best time window in terms of what's happening with the physics of the sun, what's happening with the physics of the Earth, and also it's that time window in which there no nearby supernova eruptions that could have any impact on human health, population, or civilization. But what they're writing about is, hey, the bipedal primates that preceded us, they were experiencing the norm. And therefore, it's also an explanation for why their populations never got very large. And then they end the paper by saying, we think that this also explains why molecular clocks are so discordant with a fossil record.
These are used to estimate evolutionary timescales?
Evolution, you know, Fuzz has written about this in several of his articles, so maybe I should let him speak. But, you know, molecular clocks has been a tool that evolutionary biologists have used to try to sustain their Darwinian interpretation of the history of life. And, you know, as Fuzz and I have both written, the evidence shows us that these molecular clocks are not very accurate in determining events in the history of life on planet Earth. And what Brian Thomas and his cohorts are showing is, we think at least part of the reason why are these supernova eruptions.
All right. By the way, are we due for another one anytime soon?
We're way overdue for a supernova eruption.
Okay.
I mean, the last time we had one in our galaxy was, almost 400 years ago. So given that you get 3 per century on the average, yeah, we're way overdue. And we're talking about supernova that erupt close to the Earth. We're extremely overdue.
And what would be the result of one that is nearby?
If Sirius were to go supernova, we'd be in really serious trouble.
Okay.
It's only 8 light years away. And the eruption of Sirius, the supernova eruption of Sirius, would exterminate all mammals and birds. So, and a lot of other life forms too. So yeah, no human would survive a supernova eruption of Sirius because of how close it is. On the other hand, I've got good news for you. We astronomers know what we can see in stars that we know can go supernova. What are the precursors of a supernova eruption? And we're not seeing them in Sirius, so it's not going to go supernova anytime soon. However, I can tell you the star Betelgeuse, which I think is, 300. You might know this. I think it's 300 parsecs away, which would be about 1,000 light years away.
Yeah, it was somewhere on the order of 1,000, so.
It's due to go supernova in less than 10,000 years. Hmm. So there we are seeing the precursors of a supernova eruption. We're also seeing it in the Carina Nebula, the bright star in the Carina Nebula. It's due to go supernova any time. And to an astronomer, any time is any time in the next 10,000 years. So it could be tomorrow, but it could be 10,000 years from now.
It might have already gone, and we just don't know.
That's true.
Thanks a lot.
The light hasn't gotten to us yet.
Maybe Stephen Hawking and people like him are correct. We need to find a way to get out of here. All right, Hugh. Well, thank you for that. Very interesting stuff. Okay. Jeff, you are next.
With a roll of 3.
Yeah.
I had 4.
Oh, you had
Come
4.
On.
Okay.
I had 3.
Yeah. AJ had 3. All right. You have a discovery that you want to talk about regarding a cold spot and possible evidence for a collision between universes. Well, let's hear about it because, as always, there's talk of a multiverse connected.
No, exactly. And that's the reason why I wanted to talk about this is I know that it made a splash a few, over the last couple of months is, you know, that this is maybe evidence for evidence for the existence of a multiverse so it kind of has that sort of flavor to it. And I thought it'd be worthwhile. One, to just kind of walk through what is it they're measuring and what would be the implications of it and why do people say it's a multiverse or evidence for a multiverse. But then to kind of get at a bigger question of, you know, so what, you know, just to kind of address what does it mean that if a multiverse exists, how does that really impact, you know, the Bible's description of things and kind of have a little bit of a theological discussion around it. And so what is being specifically measured is there is a cold spot in the cosmic microwave background radiation. And so this cosmic microwave background radiation is a measure of the radiation left over from the early moments of the universe, early moments being about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. It's where the universe went through a particular transition and there's a certain wavelength of light that was emitted, or, you know, on a black body spectrum. And so we can measure that light today, and because we know what its wavelength was when it, or what its characteristics when it was emitted, because we understand the physics of what caused it, when we measure it today, that tells us how far the universe has expanded, and done, it gives us some kind of neat information. But ultimately, it's a measurement of temperature, because, you know, that's what determines what the wavelength distribution, or the distribution of wavelengths in the cosmic microwave background radiation give you a temperature. And so as we look on the sky, you know, typically you see this, if you're talking about the WMAP data, it's green and red and blue and yellow colors that are distributed across the sky. With Planck, it's more orange and blue and white. But nonetheless, those are measurements of, once you take off the average temperature and subtract that out and blow up the scale and take off our motion through the universe and blow up the scale even more, you get these fluctuations in the light. Or the wavelengths, which actually tell you temperature fluctuations. And the way it's typically drawn out, colder is colder regions are blue, because when you get cold, you get blue. Redder, oranger, or hotter. And so there's this one region in the sky where they were looking at it and saying, okay, it's colder in that region. It's actually a fairly large region. And so, you know, just asking the question statistically, you know, how do we explain this? It's kind of got about a 1 chance in 50 of being a statistical fluctuation, which is a little bit out of the ordinary. It's not anything that you'd write a paper about, but it's a little bit out of the ordinary. And so what people were doing is then turning the question around, saying, all right, let's say it's a real effect. What could cause that? And one of the things that will cause the cosmic microwave background radiation, as we measure it, to be colder or bluer is how the matter is distributed. Because there's the wavelength when the microwave background radiation was emitted, but then it's propagated through the universe and it has experienced a lot of matter. And where there are regions of low density, as the photon comes into that region of low density, actually loses a bit of energy, which makes it a little bit colder. But then as it goes out the other side, it'll gain energy. And if the universe weren't expanding, that would have no effect at all. But because the universe is expanding, the energy it loses when it comes into a void is not as much, or is more than the energy it gains back when it goes out. And so they were looking to see if this explanation is that there are enough voids between us and this region where the microwave background radiation was emitted, that it could account for this bluer, the lower temperature, if you will. And the short answer is they went and did observations along that line and along a control line and found that basically the density of galaxies all along in there is about the same. So that says that it's not related to an effect after the radiation was emitted. It's actually intrinsic to the radiation, which leaves open the possibility, or as they say, it points to the possibility of a more exotic origin. So it could just be a statistical fluctuation. That's a possibility. But it could also be where our universe has collided with another universe during this epoch of inflation, and that's the signature that was left in there.
All
and
right.
So,
fair enough.
So if that's the case, or if that scenario is correct, where there was some sort of collision between our universe and another, then that's evidence for a multiverse. And so that's why it was being hailed as evidence for a multiverse.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, just as my assessment of that is that I don't see this as strong evidence for a multiverse. I do see it as a way we could test for the multiverse. But in this particular instance, you know, this could very easily be a statistical fluctuation. I mean, it's unusual, but not that out of the ordinary. You know, so it'd be kind of like if I don't know, poker's probably a bad analogy to use, but the one where you're typically dealing with probabilities. You know, if I got a royal straight flush on my first hand, that would be really unusual. If I got, you know, three of a kind on my first hand, that's unusual, but not that rare. So that's kind of the way I would put it. So whether this is a multiverse, I'm skeptical that this is particularly strong evidence, but it's kind of being hailed as that because we can't find an explanation that is related to the structure of our universe. So I thought, okay, that's kind of an interesting thing.
All right.
It does kind of hint at, though, or this question of what does it mean for there to, or what is the signature of our universe having a beginning? And, you know, I've kind of, you know, we talk about the space-time theorems or the BVG theorem, and it says, okay, that's evidence for a beginning. Well, what actually is the evidence there? And the short answer is that, you know, like with the space-time theorems of Hawking and Penrose, that they were showing that if general relativity governs the dynamics, then as you run time backwards, the trajectories eventually get to a place where the laws of physics break down. And so where the laws of physics break down, that's the beginning. That's the signature of it. Quite honestly, to a lot of physicists, where the laws of physics break down, that means we don't understand the laws of physics properly. You know, so this is kind of the argument of why people can look at the space-time theorems and they'll say, oh, that doesn't mean it's a beginning. What they're saying is the fact that the laws of physics break down is not the beginning per se. It's more that we don't understand, we don't have the proper theory of gravity, if you will. And so that's, you know, another way I'd state it is, you know, precisely where you need general relativity to be correct is right at that beginning, is where we need the quantum theory of gravity. And so we know that general relativity breaks down.
Are we talking about this time 10 to the minus 43?
Yeah, it would be very, very early in the history of the universe. And so now you've got this scenario where you've got inflation happening, which the view of inflation that actually produces a universe that looks like ours is you've got this rapidly expanding stuff, you call it a false vacuum is typically the term used for it, where it's at a higher energy state, it decays to a lower energy state and produces a bubble universe in there. And so our universe is now part of that. Well, even if, you know, this is still Big Bang cosmology, all applies inside that bubble, but even that beginning isn't quite a beginning. You know, there's still something pre-existing there. And so there's part of a discussion is, you know, when it talks about, you know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, can that just be, in some sense, a phenomenological thing, that nothing of the stuff of our universe exists outside of that, that our universe really does begin there, but it's not a foundational beginning in the sense that there's nothing before that, you know, and I think, you know, when you get to creation ex nihilo, I think that may be problematic. And so these are some of the, I was just kind of curious, throw that out for a little bit of a theological discussion is, you know, is it possible that the passages throughout Scripture where it's talking about a beginning to the universe are just a reflection of our universe began as one of these bubbles? Not that God isn't ultimately behind everything, but it's really more a phenomenological thing rather than this is actually the beginning of all existence of everything that God's ever created. I'm just kind of curious your guys' thoughts on that.
A couple of reflections on the data. One thing that makes me a little bit skeptical about the Planck data is I don't see the signature to the same degree on the WMAP 9-year data. I mean, it's almost as good as Planck. And yet that cold spot, it's faintly visible on the WMAP, but nowhere near the same degree as it is on the Planck map. So the idea that we're looking at statistical fluctuation, I think, is a real possibility.
Yeah,
given that we see an inconsistency between the two maps. The good news is there's a third satellite that may go up. It's still waiting more funding, but it would give us an even better map of the cosmic background radiation, but we're probably going to have to wait a decade before we see that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that comes out. The other thing I see about the space-time theorems is that they're really pointing to all the space-time lines of the universe coming together as an infinitesimal volume. You know, kind of like, you know, you could say a point, but it really is an infinitesimal volume. So it certainly is consistent with the beginning. But to answer your theological question, you can go to Hebrews 11:3. The universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. So if we have a beginning to the universe that comes from something beyond anything that's possible we can detect, I think you're right. That opens up quite a range of possibilities for, you know, what's responsible for bringing the universe into existence. But the idea that it can't be detected would lead me to the idea that it has to be something a little more exotic than what this paper speculates, because that is something that basically has some detectability to it.
Well, and, you know, I guess I would agree with a fair bit of that, but I guess the scenario I'm envisioning is, you know, whatever inflation does, I mean, even if, you know, quantum gravity doesn't say something about all of this, that, you know, the process by which this inflationary stuff transitions to our bubble universe, the edge of there's a boundary beyond which we could ever possibly observe. I mean, we may be able to have laws of physics that allow us to extrapolate out into that, but there's this hard wall or boundary beyond which we will ever have any sort of observations.
Well, that's the core of Hebrews 11:3, that there is a boundary.
So, but if ours is one bubble amongst a whole bunch, does that now, if that's the description that Genesis is giving, is that our bubble universe had a beginning, is that somehow inconsistent with what Scripture is saying there? Is that a phenomenological thing as the sun rises and sunsets, or is that a foundational thing that, no, the Big Bang or the beginning of the multiverse, that's what it's referring to in Genesis 1?
I think that's part of the question, right, is in the beginning of what?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, I mean, and my understanding is that we just know in the beginning. We don't have a what there, right? In the beginning, God created, right? So,
in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, which means the totality of everything we can detect, all matter, energy, space, and time. So the universe comes from something.
Well, I don't know that I would agree with that. It's the totality of everything. I don't know whether it's what we can detect or not.
Well, I'm just linking that with Hebrews 11:3.
Or does it matter? Because in the beginning of everything we could detect, I mean, that's all we're ever going to be able to detect.
Right.
Right?
So, no, that's fair, yeah.
And so does it matter if it means that beginning, or does it matter if it means the beginning of everything else that might have given rise to whatever our bubble becoming a universe or whatever the physics was that you were just talking about?
Well, and that's kind of my question is, because as I've understood creation ex nihilo, that the important part is not the timing. It's more that God is ultimately the foundation of everything. God wasn't taking something that's gone par with him and making it, that he's the source of everything.
Yes. Yeah.
So if in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth is referring to our bubble universe, if you will, and there's other stuff, is that a problem or not? I mean, it's still phenomenologically consistent in the same way we would say that, you know, the sun rising and the sun setting, that's exactly, given the frame of reference, that's correct.
I guess you get into theologically sticky ground if you suggest that other stuff that our bubble universe might have come out of is also eternal, like God's eternal.
No, that's fair. And I guess the other question ultimately that I have that I don't have a good answer to yet is that, you know, we have no problem with God creating the space and the matter and the energy, regardless of the extent of them. What if, you know, even if we assume that a beginning is a temporal thing, but time is a created quantity in the same way space is, at least according to our universe.
Yeah, so, but there are many verses that say that only God is eternal. And so the angels are not eternal. The universe is not eternal. We're not eternal, at least not eternally past.
Yeah, but if God creates something where time has no boundary, I mean, I don't see any reason why God couldn't create something where space has no boundary. That's still not in competition with him. It's still subservient to him. So could God not create something? You know, and these are speculative. I'm not pushing these, but we're amongst friends here having a conversation. So, you know, could not God create a universe where time has no boundary? So in that sense, there's no beginning the way I would measure it. But nonetheless, it still ultimately flows from him, and apart from his sustaining work, it would just tumble into non-existence.
Well, given that it flows from him, it can't be eternally existing like he is.
There Correct,
was,
yeah.
I mean, he was alone before he created anything. So,
well, that's a statement as a Trinitarian.
The whole statement of before is a temporal statement, which God creates time. So that's an ambiguous statement in my opinion.
It is in this context. I mean, I remember being in a conference on God, time, and eternity at Cambridge. And all boiled down to, you know, what is the definition of time?
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's a tough one.
You know, clearly God was having temporal experiences before he created the universe. And so does that mean that there's a kind of a more expansive definition of temporality than what we think of as cosmic time? That's certainly a possibility. And given that we're constrained to a single dimension of time, it's really very challenging for us to come up with a concrete definition of time.
I agree.
But God clearly can, because he created it. So,
So those, I mean, I just think it's kind of an interesting discussion. Yeah. But, I mean, at the end of the day, this particular discussion, it allows the possibility that a multiverse still exists. I don't think it's strong evidence for a multiverse. Mm-hmm. It just simply means that this region that we see in the cosmic microwave background radiation measured by Planck doesn't have an explanation based on the distribution of matter in between us and the region where the cosmic microwave background radiation was emitted. So it leaves open the exotic possibilities. Yeah.
Real quick, late question. Hugh, you mentioned this 9-year, was it Wilkinson?
Yeah, the Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe.
What is the difference between that and this result here?
There are just different instruments. You know, COBE was the first instrument that detected the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background radiation. WMAP was the next generation. It just had much better resolution and could map it in more detail. Planck is the successor to WMAP. So it's it's progressively better instruments that give us more and more detail of what the cosmic microwave background radiation looked like.
So why do they think they have seen an anomaly, namely a cold spot here, that the 9-year result did not?
Well, the 9-year result shows a hint of it. It's just not as definitive as what you see in the Planck map. And the reason, I mean, you know, Jeff is right, the Planck has better resolution. The WMAP, however, was 9 years of data, whereas the Planck map was just 15 months. So, I mean, they're almost comparable in terms of their quality. Yeah, and the Planck shows this quite apparent cold spot, but you don't see it, not least nowhere to the same degree in the WMAP. And, you know, one of the papers that came out on the Planck map just basically says we might not be able to get a better map. Because if you recall with Planck, it took him a long time to try to subtract the background from our galaxy and the background you get from you know, extragalactic radio sources. And I remember one of the papers that came out said, you know, this is such a difficult chore. Even if we put up a more sensitive instrument, we might not be able to do any better than we see in WMAP and Planck. But hey, they do have a proposal to send up a much superior instrument. But then you got the problem of how do you subtract off all the noise that you get from our galaxy and the extragalactic radio sources.
All right. So that would be the next generation then,
right?
Planck 2 or whatever. Okay, thank you for that. Great stuff. Okay, we will now switch it over to AJ. All right, AJ, you have written about tardigrades.
She got a score of 3.
Yeah. You guys
still coming in ahead of snake eyes.
Yeah, don't go to Las Vegas, I guess that's the word for the scholars here. Your work is well received here at RTB, so don't go to Las Vegas, I guess, is the word of caution. Unless you're invited to speak there, of course.
Of course.
You've written about tardigrades before. People have checked out your blog, I'm sure. These are water bears. I guess that's the common name for them.
That's one of the common names. Yeah, moss piglets is another one.
Ooh, there you go. Yeah. These are fascinating creatures, and you're going to tell us some more about them. I gather they are designed for some purpose.
I guess we could gather that. But my discussion about the tardigrades is actually going to be a bit of a in-depth tangent to what I've been working on. I've been working on my breakout session, one of them, for the cruise that's coming up, and that breakout session is from Blueprints to Masterpiece.
Ooh.
And I'm going to be looking at sort of some of the molecular complexities that are involved, like at the human genome level and the complexity within the genome, sort of zooming out and looking at some epigenetic complexities and the regulation of epigenetics. And then as I continue to zoom out, you know, to sort of the protein or the peptide level, I ran across a paper that's actually a couple of years old called A Million Peptide Motifs for Molecular Biologists. And in that paper, one of the authors in an interview was commenting that Sort of like Jeff was saying, you know, we had one level of instrumentation, and then we developed a more sensitive mechanism of instrumentation, and so our resolution became better, and we were able to detect more things, and so we have to modify the way we look at things. Well, if you go back two or three decades, you know, when we think about protein complexity within the human genome, we're thinking probably there's 20 to 22,000 genes in the human genome, and so the protein complexity isn't that much different than that in a chimp or some other animal. But as we start to look at peptide motifs, this one author is commenting that there are probably a million peptide motifs that are relevant to human physiology and development and human cellular biology. And many scientists will look at the different peptide motifs, which are just short portions of proteins, and say that these peptide motifs are changing so quickly that they don't really contribute to the structure of a protein. And so the structure-function paradigm of protein function and ability to process certain things in the cells isn't really applicable. And so these peptide motifs, for the large part, are probably hundreds of thousands of them are probably irrelevant. But that's really sort of filtering it through an evolutionary paradigm that you would suggest that these motifs may not have any functional relevance. And this one particular author in this paper is actually challenging that in his interview. And he's saying that there's probably a million peptide motifs that are functionally relevant. And he's basing that on the idea that we only have the ability to detect certain functions at certain times and certain snapshots, right? The way that we do molecular biology is that we're very, very good at becoming reductionistic in order to explain our particular system, our particular model. What is this protein doing mechanistically that's causing this phenomena or this process in a cellular series of processes? And so we often will reduce something to its simple terms and think that we've explained sort of how that works if we were to extrapolate it into other cell systems or into other tissues or into other organisms. And those are really bad inferences sometimes to make, because what we don't see as we become reductionistic is that we often lose the ability to see the bigger picture of how complex cellular processes are, even in a single organism like a human being, even in a single tissue type over developmental periods. And so this author's saying we can miss many of the functional relevances that are associated with these peptide motifs because we can't set up the proper experiment to say, is this particular motif functional during this particular time in development in only this particular tissue type, this particular cell type? And so there are many things that we just can't even approach because the complexity is so high and it's so difficult to sort of pick it apart, right? So I got drawn into these peptide motifs from this one article and started to learn about what are called intrinsically, help me, I'm dropping the ball already, intrinsically disordered regions, right? So proteins will often take a particular molecular form, like alpha helices or beta shapes. And even things that aren't in alpha helices or beta sheets can be loop-type structures within the protein molecule itself. And some of those loop structures are actually rigid. But others are actually not rigid. They're actually flexible. And some portions of proteins are disordered because of the amino acid sequence there. It might be an extremely hydrophilic sequence of amino acids that doesn't lend itself to like globular formation or the hiding of a hydrophobic region of a protein. And so those portions of proteins are very hard to image through things like X-ray crystallography. And what we know through different types of methodologies is that they don't hold a particular conformation. They might hold a series of conformations that differ over time or under different physiological conditions. And so they're referred to as intrinsically disordered because they don't have a specific structure associated with them. Well, it turns out there's not just regions in proteins that do this, but entire proteins that are sort of this way, that lack sort of a definitive structural form under a given physiological condition. And those are referred to as intrinsically disordered proteins, right? So that now ties into the tardigrade paper that I wanted to talk about. And so what...
You can say IDP for short, by the way.
Oh, great. So IDP, yeah, would be intrinsically disordered proteins, or IDRs would be intrinsically disordered regions, which are portions of these proteins. But yeah, the tardigrades, just to refresh your mind, they're microscopic animals, and they're actually some of the most resilient animals we know of, because they're extremely hardy under a changing environment. They can withstand extreme cold near absolute zero. They can withstand extreme heat, desiccation or drying, lack of water, where they can be reduced to 1% of their normal water content. And they can withstand these conditions, the freezing conditions, the desiccation conditions, for sometimes up to 3 decades. And
wow.
Then if they come back into a physiologically relevant or permissive environment, then they can reanimate.
What sort of size scale are these things?
Yeah, so a tardigrade from head to tail is about a half of a micron.
So smaller than a human hair type stuff.
Yeah, you could see it under a light microscope, probably.
So these are small creatures.
Not huge detail, but yeah, you can see it under a light microscope.
But nonetheless, they're multicellular.
They are definitely multicellular. They're animals. They're in the phylum of the kingdom Animalia, under the phylum Tardigrada or Tardigrada.
Wow, they get their own phylum?
They have their own phylum. There's about 1,150 species in the phylum.
They get some respect, I think.
They've been around. We can see them. We've detected them in the fossil record.
They get more respect than Pluto.
Yeah.
Well,
decades without water. Huh?
They've been around.
Hey, don't
go
there, Fuzz. We need to keep the show shorter.
530 million year old fossils indicate tardigrades have been around for quite a long time. So.
And you're talking half a micron, not half a millimeter?
Sorry, half a millimeter.
Half a millimeter.
Yeah, thank
okay,
you for the correction.
Great, sure,
thank you
yeah.
for the correction. Yeah. Hmm. These guys are amazing, and this property of desiccation tolerance, being able to withstand extremely dry conditions, has been known for a long time, for tardigrades. And one of the things that they also know is that in order for tardigrades to be able to withstand extremely dry environments, is that they actually have to have active transcription and translation that happened prior to sort of their desiccated. The dry, for their ability to sort of go dormant, right? It's called cryptobiosis. So in order for them to take on that cryptobiotic state, there actually has to be some active translation and transcription. That means making RNAs and then making proteins from those RNAs before the tardigrade's able to enter that stage, right? So this group in this paper that just came out last month in Molecular Cell has basically said, what proteins or what mRNA transcripts can we find that might suggest what's contributing to the ability of these tardigrades to go into this cryptobiotic state? And what they found is there's a series of what they call cytosolic or secreted or mitochondrial abundant heat-soluble proteins that are upregulated. That means more of them are produced when you start to subject the tardigrade to a drying environment, right? And so they went in and they asked, of all of these transcripts that we can find, whether they're cytosolic proteins or secreted proteins or mitochondrial-related proteins, which ones of them might be contributing to the ability of the tardigrade to survive? And so they identified about a dozen in the cytosol. They identified a couple that were secreted, and then they honed in on these, and they said, what do we know about these proteins? Are any of them like these IDPs? Because what we know about IDPs is that they can form sort of aggregates or secondary structure that can sometimes sort of go into phase transitions, which might be what's going on with the tardigrades. And so they honed in on these. They did a lot of analytical method testing of the different proteins. They confirmed by bioinformatics, which basically models and predicts secondary structure and tertiary structure of different proteins based on the amino acid sequences, which they determined from the RNA transcripts. And they said, which ones of these are good candidates for possibly being these types of proteins? And they narrowed it down to, I think, about four that they went ahead and examined, and they said, okay, if we look at these four proteins, if we inhibit their function by putting in what's called RNAi, which is an inhibitory RNA that basically will form complexes with the message and basically block the message from being translated into proteins, can we sort of cripple the tardigrade so it's no longer resistant to drying conditions? And they were able to do that. And they're like, so, okay, pass the first hurdle. So then they take those same transcripts and they engineer them into bacteria and into yeast, and they say, if we produce these proteins in bacteria or yeast, can we make the bacteria and yeast more hardy if they undergo drying conditions? And they were able to do that. And so then they said, okay, well, this is great. You know, maybe we can even express this protein or these proteins, and we can add it to another protein that we're going to dry just in vitro. So they take an enzymatic protein that has activity, like lactose dehydrogenase. They dry it in the presence of these different proteins, and they say, are these proteins able to protect the enzymatic function of the LDH? And they showed that they were able to protect the enzymatic function of LDH. And so the hypothesis is that these proteins they've identified, which all have these intrinsically disordered regions, they're all considered intrinsically disordered proteins, are actually what's contributing to the tardigrade's ability to survive, at least under this one harsh environmental condition of a lack of water, mm-hmm. right? And so others have predicted that these genes that tardigrades that pick up that help them to survive under these harsh conditions are probably multifunctional in the sense that, well, if it helps it under drying conditions, it'll probably also help it under freezing conditions, right? So whatever the tardigrade's picking up, it's probably got multiple roles of function that contribute to the tardigrade's phenotype in a variety of different harsh environments. And what this group did is they basically tested that theory with these proteins and said, okay, we know it contributes to its ability to survive under dry conditions. What about under freezing conditions? And the answer was no. Right? So is that a failed prediction from sort of evolutionary type thinking? I wouldn't go that far as to say that. But what they're showing again is that we only are understanding one sort of snapshot of a functional application of these proteins in tardigrades. And it's not going to explain all of the phenotype that's unique to the tardigrade under these various environmental conditions. We still have to do the hard work and find out what other things are accounting for its ability to withstand radiation or high pressure or freezing temperatures, right? So, but anyway, I just really like it. The tardigrade-specific IDPs, yeah. So they went out into the database and they said, do we see these proteins other places? And they don't. They don't see any homologs in any other species. And it used to be thought that what was giving the tardigrade the ability to withstand drying conditions was a sugar molecule called trehalose. Am I saying that right, Fuzz?
Yep.
Yeah, trehalose. And the reason is because that sugar molecule in other organisms, particularly plants, will allow plants to undergo drying conditions or desiccation. And so it was hypothesized for a very long time that tardigrades must be producing trehalose and that must be what's giving this the survival capability. And it's not, in fact. And so anyway, back to these proteins and sort of these motifs. I just think it's remarkably complex. And it's almost as soon as we learn something and we start to see sort of the specificities of how it plays out in a particular animal like a tardigrade, and then we go out into the database and we look for homologs. Sometimes we find homologs, and that'll lead us to particular inferences. But I think every time we jump to those inferences, those conclusions based on inference, we have to be really careful because we don't know that that protein is necessarily going to have the same function. And even more complex than that is, well, we know this protein has this function in this tardigrade under these conditions, but what's accounting for all of the other sort of variations that we see in various species of tardigrades? Are they all relying upon this type of protein, or is it even more complex than that? So I'm going to be blogging about this shortly, so you'll get to read all about it again, Joe, now that you're editing our blogs for
cool,
us.
Cool, yeah.
And hopefully I'll be able to bring out a few more points there that I don't want to spend time on today.
Quick question. Does the tardigrade go into a state of hibernation, or does
not,
it keep
not really it,
metabolism
it stays,
going?
It sta- well, so when it goes into cryptobiosis, right, it does. It basically slows its metabolic processes to a fraction of what they normally are. And by that, I mean extremely low, less than 1% of normal metabolic processes. And that would make sense because basically if you've gone into some form of stasis, for a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades,
yeah,
you can't actually be keeping a lot of metabolic processes running, or else you're going to deplete your internal
right
resources. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, remarkable stuff. Yeah.
Phenomenal creatures. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they think that there'll be applications of taking these proteins and possibly producing sort of hardier crops.
Development of technologies, dry preservation of pharmaceutical cells and tissues.
Yeah.
Any comment on that?
Yeah, actually, one comment. Thanks for asking. I didn't feed you that question, but that's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. So like with the lactose dehydrogenase, where they showed that if they added this protein to that, they could actually stabilize it under drying conditions, and then they could reconstitute it and it would remain functional. Well, the problem with that, it's a great idea and it's a great application, but right now, without any more fine-tuning of what they found, it's probably unrealistic, because what they don't tell you straight out in the paper, but you can find if you dig through the methods and do a little bit of calculations based on their figures in there, is that you have 100% lactose dehydrogenase enzymatic recovery, but only when you dry it in the presence of a 200-fold increase of this tardigrade-specific IDP. So that ratio won't sell in pharmaceuticals, right? You can't add 200 times the amount of a protein that's going to preserve the protein of interest, because then you have purification and all kinds of potential side effects.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Fuzz, who worked in pharmaceuticals?
Wow. Great stuff. And these tiny creatures. Impressive. Okay, well, thank you for that. AJ, anything else from anybody? Otherwise, thank you for that. I have learned a lot. Okay, we will switch it over to Fuzz now. Fuzz, as usual, I've enjoyed reading the article you passed along, although I do have a complaint. I think they fed these tiny slugs some poison, and I wasn't pleased to hear about that, but...
Hey, life is hard.
That's
when you're a sea slug, life is hard.
Yeah, sea slug gets poisoned on the brain, no less. But then they got it to swim. That's how science progresses, huh?
There we go.
All right, well, tell us more about this discovery and the implications. I guess it has evolutionary implications, right?
Yeah, well, this is what I'm going to talk about is a paper that will be published June 19th in a journal called Current Biology, and it's work reported on by scientists from Georgia State University. And they were, as we alluded to, measuring and characterizing basically the neurocircuitry involved in the swimming behavior of a certain group of sea slugs. And the technical name for the group that the sea slugs belong to are the nudibranchs. And they discovered something about the neurocircuitry that was completely unexpected.
Who comes up with these names? That's a great name. Nudibranchs?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Pretty cool, huh?
I don't know.
Giant nudibranch.
And the hooded nudibranch. We're going to talk about both of those. But they discovered something completely unexpected about the neural circuitry of these two sea slugs. And that unexpected discovery, in effect, represents... or illustrates reasons why I'm skeptical about the evolutionary paradigm. In fact, you could argue that what they discovered technically would be a failed prediction that flows out of the evolutionary paradigm. And the reason why this article caught my attention, at least from an apologetic standpoint, is there's a book that's been published recently called Adam and the Genome. It's getting quite a bit of exposure and creating quite a bit of conversation.
And you're giving it more exposure now.
I know. But it's among evangelicals, because it's a book in which there is a case being made for evolutionary creationism, the idea that God employed evolutionary mechanisms to create life on Earth, including human beings. And the two authors of the book are a biologist by the name of Dennis Venema and a New Testament scholar by the name of Scott McKnight. And it's really kind of two books in one, where Dennis Venema makes a case scientifically for biological evolution and specifically human evolution, and then Scott McKnight kind of wrestles through the implications of that, trying to argue that a reading of the biblical text doesn't demand a historical Adam. And if people are interested, I've written a two-part critical reflection on the book that we published on our website. So people can go there if they want to see some more of that. But one of the points that Dennis Venema makes in the book, and this is not a point unique to Dennis Venema, I've seen a lot of evolutionary biologists make this comparable point, and that is, evolution is such a successful theory that it has explanatory power and predictive power, that when we apply evolutionary theory to studying biological diversity or biological design, to the history of life on Earth, the origin of life, that it successfully makes predictions about what we should discover. And this is a point that Dennis Venema made time and time again, but this study actually illustrates the fact that that's not the case, that there are many times where the paradigm actually does not make successful predictions. And in fact, over the course of the last few weeks, I've been doing Facebook Live sessions every Monday morning, or at least that's the goal. And in the past two sessions, we actually talked about discoveries that have happened in anthropology that represent failed predictions about the location for the origin of the hominins, as well as a failed prediction about the time frame in which Homo naledi would have appeared. So people can go to my Facebook page and they can find those broadcasts if they want to watch them. But this represents another example of, again, a failed prediction. So in the span of about 3 weeks, I've uncovered three examples of failed predictions, not looking for them. These are just failed predictions that have fallen on my lap as I've been just monitoring the scientific literature. And so to give a little bit of background as to what this study involved and why it's a failed prediction, these researchers were studying sea slugs. And there's about 2,000 species of sea slugs.
Wow.
There's the fact for the day. But only about 50 of them actually are capable of swimming. And they have a characteristic swimming type behavior where it's kind of a left-right movement. They call it a left-right flexion movement that's characteristic. And it turns out that if you look at those 50 swimming nudibranchs, they all would cluster into the same biological grouping. If you look at them from a genetic standpoint, if you compare their genetic makeup, they would all cluster into the same grouping. Evolutionary biologists would interpret this in an evolutionary framework and say that they are monophyletic, that they belong to the same evolutionary branch in an evolutionary tree. Well, if that's the case, then you would expect that everything about them should be homologous, meaning that they should have shared features that reflect features that would have existed in the ancestral species of nudibranchs that gave rise to those 50 swimming nudibranchs, meaning there should be a homologous genetic structure to these nudibranchs, but also their morphology, their behavior should also be homologous. In addition to that, if you extend it now into their neural structures that are controlling these movements, the neurons are expected to be homologous, and the neural circuitry, the way in which the neurons interact with each other to produce the behavior, should be homologous. And sea slugs are really great model systems to study the relationship between neuronal structure, neural circuitry, and behavior, because they have a relatively simple nervous system. The neurons are rather large, and so they can be labeled, and their behavior can be studied. You can actually control the firing of the neurons through poisons that are neuroinhibitors, or you can use a technique called dynamic patch clamping, where you can force electrical current into the circuitry, causing the neurons to fire differently. And so it's a great model system to study because of the simplicity of a neural system and the ability to manipulate it, and the behaviors that are produced are rather simple as well. So it's a great foundational system just to learn neurobiology principles. And just again to illustrate the fact that that again the predictions are that the behavior, the neuronal structure, and the neural circuitry should all be homologous. I want to read you a statement from the abstract of the paper and the first sentence in the introduction of the paper. Behavioral homology is often assumed to involve similarity in underlying neural mechanisms. That sounds like a prediction to me. Behaviors that are homologous and similar in form would naturally be assumed to be produced by similar neural mechanisms. Again, another prediction. But what they discovered when they studied, again, the giant nudibranch and the hooded nudibranch is that while the neuronal structure is indeed homologous, the neural circuitry that produces identical swimming behavior is completely different. One nudibranch has an incredibly elaborate, complex neural circuitry. The other one, a relatively simple neural circuitry. So the neural circuits are not even related to each other, or you can't say one is a derivative of the other. They basically are completely distinct and different. And what's interesting is, just as an aside, is they actually could go in and rewire the neural circuitry of one nudibranch to be like the other one and produce identical behavior, which suggests from a neurological standpoint that neural circuitry is actually fairly plastic, that there's a plasticity to this neural circuitry that, in other words, the same neuronal structure can have very different circuitry and produce identical behaviors. Even though the neural circuitry is different. That's kind of a very important aside just from a neurobiology standpoint. But from
is what's going on in here is that you've got these things that look like they have a similar neuronal structure, but the way it cashes out in terms of causing behavior is very different
in these two. So in other words, the way in which the neurons are interacting with each other to create the behavior is very different. They can actually literally map out the activity of each of the neurons throughout the course of the behavior, and so the pattern of neuronal firing is very different.
So presumably, in an evolutionary scenario, you've got some sort of ancestor, I think that's the correct term, ancestor that branches off and gives all of these that had a certain neuronal structure. They've all somehow that neuronal structure has changed, but ultimately still produces the exact same behavior.
No, it you're close, but not exactly. In evolutionary theory, if you have members that belong to the same evolutionary lineage and they have shared behaviors, the assumption is that the ancestor would have had those behaviors or would have had that morphology or would have had that genetic makeup, depending on what feature you're looking at.
Okay.
So what they're able to show is genetically they're monophyletic. The behavior is the same. The neuronal structure, the way in which the brain is wired is the same, or the neural system is wired. I don't know if they technically have a brain. And yet, when you look at the way the neurons fire, they're completely different.
Right.
But the expectation is the way in which the neurons would fire should be the same. Now,
So in an evolutionary explanation to explain that, you've got to start with something that gave rise to these different organisms that somehow diversified the neuronal pathways from the same neuronal structure but gives the same behavior,
which is bizarre, I guess. Yeah, so now you could argue that if these nudibranchs were not monophyletic, if they belonged to different groups and they had the same behavior
convergence
and the same neural structure but different neural firing mechanisms, then you could say this is an example of convergence.
Right, okay.
But the fact that they belong to the same branch is completely unexpected. It essentially is a failed prediction. Now, what's very interesting is how the researchers interpret this, where they basically just invent a phenomena that nobody has any evidence exists. They dub it an example of neural drift, where maybe as these two organisms diverge, that the neural pathways just simply start drifting from one another, winding up with two very different neural types of circuitry.
All the while producing the same behavior.
Yes. And okay. So I just basically, frankly, just call BS here. Okay, because, and I mean this with all respect, they're just making up literally a phantom phenomena that we have no evidence that exists to explain and mask the fact that this is actually a failed prediction.
Mm-hmm. So let me devil's advocate for just a second, or maybe not even that, just a question from a perspective devil's advocate. So if I were to take if I were able to map the neural pathways that fire during the human fight or flight response, if I did that for you and I did it for somebody else who lived in a different culture and had a very different metabolic system and different diet and, you know, even in a different time zone, so they're on a different night day sleep cycle than you are. Would you expect those neural pathways to fire similarly? Or if you have two very different breeds of dogs and you're demonstrating a Pavlovian response in both of them, would you expect the neural pathway signaling to be the same in the dogs?
Well, I don't know how to answer that question. And the reason why is because you're dealing with a neural system that is so more vastly complex than what this
than a sea slug.
Than yep. a sea slug. And there could be other factors that were just that we simply can't dissects it. Mm-hmm. So in other words, what they're
enough.
I mean, the work that they've done is absolutely astounding. It is state of the art, science at its best, you know, and they're dealing with a very complex system, though it's simple, right? And
right.
So I don't know how to answer that question.
Fair enough.
But it's very clear, and again, this is not me saying this is a prediction. This is what they have said in their underdog. That's why I wanted to read it, because this is the prediction they said that they've offered as evolutionary biologists. Now, to be fair, you could argue this isn't enough to overthrow the evolutionary paradigm as a failed prediction. Okay, I won't argue with that, but what it is saying, and this is going to the point you made, AJ, is that to claim that nothing in biology makes sense except in light of evolution is really an unsubstantiated claim, because you cannot say evolution can explain the origin of life, the design of life, the history of life, the diversity of life, the biogeographical distribution of life, that it has this all-encompassing explanatory power, that it successfully makes predictions, because it doesn't. Okay, this is an example of where the paradigm doesn't make a successful prediction. So, And my point would be, at minimum, it's reasonable for somebody to come along and say, wait a minute, either evolutionary theory is not complete and it needs to be expanded, or there might be something else going on here.
You know, and I'm extremely sympathetic and supportive of your call of BS, in the sense of, we don't understand what we're seeing here mechanistically and phenomenologically. And so now we're going to come up with this brilliant scientific term to basically fill in this naturalistic mechanistic gap, and we're going to call it neuronal drift. And now we're going to have other people who read this paper and pick up on that phrase and start to explain things in light of neuronal drift. Whereas you haven't demonstrated anything mechanistically. You've demonstrated a point of ignorance, and you've labeled it something scientifically to give somebody reins to run with the evolutionary story in future publications.
Yes.
Well, there's another factor at work here, too, is you've got specialists looking at this and saying, okay, looks like a failed prediction. How can we get around it?
Absolutely.
Assuming that there aren't other failed predictions in the evolutionary model.
Yeah.
I mean, if you actually look at the whole breadth of evolutionary biology, they're everywhere. But I notice the specialists seem to think there's only one or two that are not... Apparently, they're not aware.
Well,
that
and
this
again,
is a pervasive phenomenon.
Sort of back to the paper that led into my paper. You know, there's this idea of, as experts, we become so reductionistic and so focused on our one field of expertise that we might see one or two failed predictions, but we've adopted the paradigm, and we need to stick with the paradigm in explaining our failed predictions, and we don't sort of back up and take a long time with a very critical eye to try and see if the paradigm's really holding across other systems and other disciplines.
I like what you say, because what you're basically saying is, hey, if I see a failed prediction in my narrow area of expertise, I should step back and say, is this something that's happening in other areas especially? And so frequently that's not done.
I would be curious. I mean, I think your point about the overstatement that it just makes predictions and it leads us to the right path all the time, Yeah, so I would just take that as a given. I kind of ask a different question here. You're saying, okay, so they posit this neuronal drift. Is this something that, in principle, you could actually go out and measure? So is this really just, we don't know what's going on here, so we're going to call it neuronal drift, and we'll say this happens. Is this, I mean, I could see where you could go out and find other examples where it might be the case, but that's not really solving the problem, if you will. Can you actually measure in principle that something like this would happen?
I don't know the answer to that question, in part because I'm not really I'm not a neuroscientist.
Fair.
So I don't know how you would necessarily conceive of that kind of experiment. There may be a way to do it. But again, it's just interesting to read between the lines.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Here's the concluding paragraph. One can only speculate about the reasons why neural mechanisms for homologous behaviors might have diverged. Perhaps some of the neurons in one or the other species have taken on additional functions that provide selective pressure to alter the ancestral connectivity. Perhaps there was no selective advantage to either conformation, and they both function well enough, permitting the circuitry merely to drift away from their ancestral state and become stabilized in the current species-typical configurations. This neural drift, in quotes, might be analogous to genetic drift, wherein mutations accumulate over time, hidden from phenotypic change until they are fixed by selection. So this is basically
Sheer speculation.
Within a paradigm. And to me, I think, as I said earlier, this may not be sufficient to overthrow the mm-hmm. paradigm.
Right.
But I think the honest thing to say would be, look, as evolutionary biologists, we believe that theory does a reasonable job of accounting for mm-hmm. some of the data that's out there, but there are still areas where the theory doesn't actually make successful predictions, and that means we either don't have an all-encompassing theory, or we don't have enough of an understanding of some of these processes, you know, to fully explain it with the theory. That would be the honest thing to say. I could live with that, because then it says to people who maybe are uncomfortable with the implications of the evolutionary paradigm, it says to them that this is not something that I have to accept, that has to be ramrodded down my throat. Or to theologians in the church today who are feeling pressured from groups, frankly, like BioLogos, mm-hmm. that evolution is a established fact. It's the only way to approach the history of life on Earth. We've got to accept it and accommodate theology to this idea. Theologians are feeling bullied and pressured into going down certain paths mm-hmm. that they may not necessarily feel comfortable going, but they think they have no choice.
Right.
And it's because there's not, I think, an honest presentation of what the theory can and can't do, and on an honest discussion of this is where the theory actually seems to break down.
An honest scientific discussion about, well, hey, wait a minute, why are you employing this new phrase when what you've basically, you haven't been able to demonstrate an underlying naturalistic mechanism. So why employ a new phrase to cover up something that's inexplicable at this point in time? Why not just say, at this point in time, it's inexplicable, and maybe it's a problem with our theory, and maybe it's a problem of just not having enough data.
Yeah, yes. I'm motivated to make a bold prediction that this paper will be frequently cited as proof that we've got an explanation for these neural differences, and it's called neural drift.
Maybe.
So,
yes.
I'll bet you there'll be two dozen citations to that effect.
This paragraph that Fuzz read at the end just really brought back a memory that I've shared sometime in some of my talks about graduate school, where there was a graduate student the year ahead of me that did some really stellar work. And he went on to be a very successful research professor at a very good university. And he was giving his dissertation defense, and he just gave a brilliant presentation. I mean, this guy knew his stuff inside and out, and he knew other people's stuff fairly well too. And I just remember sitting in his dissertation defense thinking, wow, what a great project, what a really good job you did. And one of the professors in the back near the end of his presentation raised her hand. And she said, you know, really nice presentation, but I'd like you to explain to me what you've basically presented here in light of how you think this came about through evolution. And I saw this brilliant student that, you know, had mastered pretty much everything that he'd put his hands to in graduate school. Pause, actually look briefly stunned for a moment, and what was going through my head was, what's evolution got to do with anything he just talked about? And I can honestly tell you, I don't think that guy had ever thought about his work in the context of evolution ever once. And so after about a legitimate 30, 40 second pause, he attempts to address the professor's question. And it was the first time I've ever heard him say anything that was just kind of like, well, maybe this, maybe that, speculate this, not really sure, maybe that. And the professor's response was, well, good, at least you're now thinking about it in that context. And I've thought about that so many times over the past few decades. We grew up in a system as research scientists where we were asked to take our data, and despite whether or not it had any relevance to the questions we were asking experimentally, how does this fit into this paradigm? And in fact, maybe it doesn't fit into that paradigm. All right. So anyway, I throw that out there because, you know, for decades, scientists have been trained to think in terms of this paradigm. And if the paradigm really has multiple small failings and they start to stack up, then when do we start to ask, when do we start to understand what we're doing, maybe in the context of a different paradigm or one that doesn't restrict the way we think about things?
Yes.
All right. Great stuff. Thanks to each of you for bringing these reports to our attention. Thank you for listening. We hope this will help equip you in your ministry ventures. You know how to interact with the scholars here. You can follow them on Facebook and Twitter. On behalf of the team, Hugh, Fuzz, Jeff, and AJ, this is Joe Aguirre. Thank you for your support. We will see you next time on Scientifica.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.